buy flood insurance on the house in the valley for the same price as flood insurance on the house on the mountaintop. The market made no sense, but that didn't stop other Wall Street firms from jumping into it, in part because Mike Berry was pestering them. For weeks, he hounded Bank of America until they agreed to sell him $5 million in credit default swaps. 20 minutes after they sent their email confirming the trade, they received another back from Berry. So can we do another? In a few weeks, Mike Berry bought several $100 million in credit default swaps from half a dozen banks in chunks of $5 million. None of the sellers appeared to care very much which bonds they were insuring. He found one mortgage pool that was 100% floating-rate negative amortizing mortgages, where the borrowers could choose the option of not paying any interest at all and simply accumulate a bigger and bigger debt until, presumably, they defaulted on it. Goldman Sachs not only sold him insurance on the pool, but sent him a little note congratulating him on being the first person, on Wall Street or off, ever to buy insurance on that particular item. "I'm educating the experts here," Berry crowed in an email. He wasn't wasting a lot of time worrying about why these supposedly shrewd investment bankers were willing to sell him insurance so cheaply. He was worried that others would catch on and the opportunity would vanish. "I would play dumb quite a bit," he said, "making it seem to them like I don't really know what I'm doing. How do you do this again? Oh, where can I find that information? Or, really?" when they tell me something really obvious. It was one of the fringe benefits of living for so many years essentially alienated from the world around him. He could easily believe that he was right and the world was wrong. The more Wall Street firms jumped into the new business, the easier it became for him to place his bets. For the first few months, he was able to short, at most, $10 million at a time. Then in late June 2005, he had a call from someone at Goldman Sachs asking him if he'd like to increase his trade size to $100 million a pop. "What needs to be remembered here," he wrote the next day after he'd done it, "is that this is $100 million. That's an insane amount of money, and it just gets thrown around like it's three digits instead of nine." By the end of July, he owned credit default swaps on $750 million in subprime mortgage bonds and was privately bragging about it. "I believe no other hedge fund on the planet has this sort of investment, nowhere near to this degree, relative to the size of the portfolio," he wrote to one of his investors, who had caught wind that his hedge fund manager had some newfangled strategy. Now he couldn't help but wonder who exactly was on the other side of his trades. What madman would be selling him so much insurance on bonds he had hand-picked to explode? The credit default swap was a zero-sum game. If Mike Berry made $100 million when the subprime mortgage bonds he had hand-picked defaulted, someone else must have lost $100 million. Goldman Sachs made it clear that the ultimate seller wasn't Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs was simply standing between insurance buyer and insurance seller and taking a cut. The willingness of whoever this person was to sell him such vast amounts of cheap insurance gave Mike Berry another idea: to start a fund that did nothing but buy insurance on subprime mortgage bonds. In a $600 million fund that was meant to be picking stocks, his bet was already gargantuan, but if he could raise the money explicitly for this new purpose, he could do many billions more. In August, he wrote a proposal for a fund he called Milton's Opus and sent it out to his investors. The first question was always, "What's Milton's Opus?" He'd say, "Paradise Lost," but that usually just raised another question. Most of them still had no idea that their champion stock picker had become so diverted by these esoteric insurance contracts called credit default swaps. Many wanted nothing to do with it. A few wondered if this meant that he was already doing this sort of thing with their money. Instead of raising more money to buy credit default swaps on subprime mortgage bonds, he wound up making it more difficult to keep the ones he already owned. His investors were happy to let him pick stocks on their behalf, but they almost universally doubted his ability to foresee big macroeconomic trends, and they certainly didn't see why he should have any special insight into the multi-trillion-dollar subprime mortgage bond market. Milton's Opus died a quick death. In October 2005, in his letter to investors, Barry finally came completely clean and let them know that they owned at least $1 billion in credit default swaps on subprime mortgage bonds. "Sometimes markets err big time," he wrote. "Markets erred when they gave America Online the currency to buy Time Warner. They erred when they bet against George Soros and for the British pound. And they are erring right now by continuing to float along as if the most significant credit bubble history has ever seen does not exist. Opportunities are rare, and large opportunities on which one can put nearly unlimited capital to work at tremendous potential returns are even more rare. Selectively shorting the most problematic mortgage-backed securities in history today amounts to just such an opportunity." In the second quarter of 2005, credit card delinquencies hit an all-time high, even though house prices had boomed. That is, even with this asset to borrow against, Americans were struggling more than ever to meet their obligations. The Federal Reserve had raised interest rates, but mortgage rates were still effectively falling because Wall Street was finding ever more clever ways to enable people to borrow money. Barry now had more than a $1 billion bet on the table and couldn't grow it much more unless he attracted a lot more money. So he just laid it out for his investors. The U.S. mortgage bond market was huge, bigger than the market for U.S. Treasury notes and bonds. The entire economy was premised on its stability, and its stability in turn depended on house prices continuing to rise. "It is ludicrous to believe that asset bubbles can only be recognized in hindsight," he wrote. "There are specific identifiers that are entirely recognizable during the bubble's inflation. One hallmark of mania is the rapid rise in the incidence and complexity of fraud. The FBI reports mortgage-related fraud is up fivefold since 2000. Bad behavior was no longer on the fringes of an otherwise sound economy. It was its central feature. The salient point about the modern vintage of housing-related fraud is its integral place within our nation's institutions," Barry added. This wasn't all that different from what he'd been saying in his quarterly letters to his investors for the past 2 years. Back in July 2003, he'd written them a long essay on the causes and consequences of what he took to be a likely housing crash. "Alan Greenspan assures us that home prices are not prone to bubbles or major deflations on any national scale," he'd said. "This is ridiculous, of course. In 1933, during the fourth year of the Great Depression, the United States found itself in the midst of a housing crisis that put housing starts at 10% of the level of 1925. Roughly half of all mortgage debt was in default. During the 1930s, housing prices collapsed nationwide by roughly 80%. He harped on the same theme again in January 2004, then again in January 2005. "Want to borrow $1 million for just $25 a month?" he wrote. "Quicken Loans has now introduced an interest-only adjustable-rate mortgage that gives borrowers 6 months with both zero payments and a 0.03% interest rate, no doubt in support of that wholesome slice of Americana, the homebuyer with the short-term cash flow problem." When his investors learned that their money manager had actually put their money directly where his mouth had long been, they were not exactly pleased. As one investor put it, "Mike's the best stock picker anyone knows, and he's doing what?" Some were upset that a guy they had hired to pick stocks had gone off to pick rotten mortgage bonds instead. Some wondered, if credit default swaps were such a great deal, why Goldman Sachs would be selling them. Some questioned the wisdom of trying to call the top of a 70-year housing cycle. Some didn't really understand exactly what a credit default swap was or how it worked. "It has been my experience that apocalyptic forecasts on the U.S. financial markets are rarely realized within limited horizons," one investor wrote to Barry. "There have been legitimate apocalyptic cases to be made on U.S. financial markets during most of my career. They usually have not been realized." Barry replied that while it was true that he foresaw Armageddon, he wasn't betting on it. That was the beauty of credit default swaps. They enabled him to make a fortune if just a tiny fraction of these dubious pools of mortgages went bad. Inadvertently, he'd opened up a debate with his own investors, which he counted among his least favorite activities. "I hated discussing ideas with investors," he said, "because I then become a defender of the idea, and that influences your thought process. Once you became an idea's defender, you had a harder time changing your mind about it." He had no choice. Among the people who gave him money, there was pretty obviously a built-in skepticism of so-called macro thinking. They could understand why this very bright guy rooting around in financial statements might stumble across a small company no one else was paying attention to. They couldn't see why he should have a deeper understanding of trends and global forces apparent to any American who flipped on a cable news program. "I have heard that White Mountain would rather I stick to my knitting," he wrote, testily, to his original backer, "though it is not clear to me that White Mountain has historically understood what my knitting really is." No one seemed to be able to see what was so plain to him. These credit default swaps were all part of his global search for value. "I don't take breaks in my search for value," he wrote to White Mountains. "There is no golf or other hobby to distract me. Seeing value is what I do." When he'd started Scion, he'd told potential investors that because he was in the business of making unfashionable bets, they should evaluate him over the long term, say 5 years. Now he was being evaluated moment to moment. "Early on, people invested in me because of my letters," he said, "and then somehow, after they invested, they stopped reading them." His fantastic success attracted lots of new investors, but they were less interested in the spirit of his enterprise than in how much money he could make them quickly. Every quarter, he told them how much he'd made or lost from his stock picks. Now he had to explain that they had to subtract from that number these subprime mortgage bond insurance premiums. One of his New York investors called and said ominously, "You know, a lot of people are talking about withdrawing funds from you." As their funds were contractually stuck inside Scion Capital for some time, the investor's only recourse was to send him disturbed-sounding emails asking him to justify his new strategy. "People get hung up on the difference between plus 5% and minus 5% for a couple of years," Barry replied to one investor who had protested the new strategy, "when the real issue is, over 10 years, who does 10% basis points better annually? And I firmly believe that to achieve that advantage on an annual basis, I have to be able to look out past the next couple of years. I have to be steadfast in the face of popular discontent, if that's what the fundamentals tell me." In the 5 years since he had started, the S&P 500, against which he was measured, was down 6.84%. In the same period, he reminded his investors, Scion Capital was up 242%. He assumed he'd earned the rope to hang himself. He assumed wrong. "I'm building breathtaking sandcastles," he wrote, "but nothing stops the tide from coming and coming and coming." Oddly, as Mike Berry's investors grew restive, his Wall Street counterparties took a new and envious interest in what he was up to. In October 2005, a subprime trader at Goldman Sachs called to ask him why he was buying credit default swaps on such very specific tranches of subprime mortgage bonds. The trader let it slip that a number of hedge funds had been calling Goldman to ask how to do the short housing trade that Scion is doing. Among those asking about it were people Barry had solicited for Milton's Opus, people who had initially expressed great interest. These people, by and large, did not know anything about how to do the trade and expected Goldman to help them replicate it, Barry wrote in an email to his CFO. "My suspicion is Goldman helped them, though they deny it." If nothing else, he now understood why he couldn't raise money for Milton's Opus. "If I describe it enough, it sounds compelling, and people think they can do it for themselves," he wrote to an email confidant. "If I don't describe it enough, it sounds scary and binary, and I can't raise the capital." He had no talent for selling. Now, the subprime mortgage bond market appeared to be unraveling. Out of the blue, on November 4th, Barry had an email from the head subprime guy at Deutsche Bank, a fellow named Greg Lippmann. As it happened, Deutsche Bank had broken off relations with Mike Berry back in June, after Barry had been, in Deutsche Bank's view, overly aggressive in his demands for collateral. Now this guy calls and says he'd like to buy back the original 6 credit default swaps Cyan had bought in May. As the $60 million represented a tiny slice of Barry's portfolio, and as he didn't want any more to do with Deutsche Bank than Deutsche Bank wanted to do with him, he sold them back at a profit. Greg Lippman wrote back, hastily and ungrammatically, "Would you like to give us some other bonds that we can tell you what we will pay you?" Greg Lippman of Deutsche Bank wanted to buy his $1 billion in credit default swaps. "Thank you for the look, Greg," Barry replied. "We're good for now." He signed off, thinking, "How strange. I haven't dealt with Deutsche Bank in 5 months. How does Greg Lippman even know I own this giant pile of credit default swaps?" 3 days later, he heard from Goldman Sachs. His saleswoman, Veronica Grinstein, called him on her cell phone, which is what she did when she wanted to talk without being recorded. Wall Street firms now recorded all calls made from their trading desks. "I'd like a special favor," she asked. She, too, wanted to buy some of his credit default swaps. "Management is concerned," she said. They thought the traders had sold all this insurance without having any place they could go to buy it back. Could Mike Barry sell them $25 million of the stuff, at really generous prices, on the subprime mortgage bonds of his choosing? Just to placate Goldman management, you understand. Hanging up, he pinged Bank of America, on a hunch, to see if they would sell him more. They wouldn't. They, too, were looking to buy. Next came Morgan Stanley, again out of the blue. He hadn't done much business with Morgan Stanley, but evidently Morgan Stanley, too, wanted to buy whatever he had. He didn't know exactly why all these banks were suddenly so keen to buy insurance on subprime mortgage bonds, but there was one obvious reason. The loans suddenly were going bad at an alarming rate. Back in May, Mike Barry was betting on his theory of human behavior. The loans were structured to go bad. Now, in November, they were actually going bad. The next morning, Barry opened the Wall Street Journal to find an article explaining how the new wave of adjustable-rate mortgages were defaulting in their first 9 months at rates never before seen. Lower-middle-class America was tapped out. There was even a little chart to show readers who didn't have time to read the article. He thought, "The cat's out of the bag. The world's about to change. Lenders will raise their standards. Rating agencies will take a closer look, and no dealers in their right mind will sell insurance on subprime mortgage bonds at anything like the prices they've been selling it. I'm thinking the light bulb is going to pop on and some smart credit officer is going to say, 'Get out of these trades,'" he said. Most Wall Street traders were about to lose a lot of money, with perhaps one exception. Mike Barry had just received another email from one of his own investors that suggested that Deutsche Bank might have been influenced by his one-eyed view of the financial markets. "Greg Lippman, the head subprime mortgage trader at Deutsche Bank, was in here the other day," it read. "He told us that he was short $1 billion of this stuff and was going to make oceans of money," or something to that effect. His exuberance was a little scary. Chapter 3. How can a guy who can't speak English lie? By the time Greg Lippman turned up in the Front Point conference room in February 2006, Steve Eisman knew enough about the bond market to be wary, and Vincent Daniel knew enough to have decided that no one in it could ever be trusted. An investor who went from the stock market to the bond market was like a small furry creature raised on an island without predators, removed to a pit full of pythons. It was possible to get ripped off by the big Wall Street firms in the stock market, but you really had to work at it. The entire market traded on screens, so you always had a clear view of the price of the stock of any given company. The stock market was not only transparent, but heavily policed. You couldn't expect a Wall Street trader to share with you his every negative thought about public companies, but you could expect he wouldn't work very hard to sucker you with outright lies, or blatantly use inside information to trade against you, mainly because there was at least a chance he'd be caught if he did. The presence of millions of small investors had politicized the stock market. It had been legislated and regulated to at least seem fair. The bond market, because it consisted mainly of big institutional investors, experienced no similarly populist political pressure. Even as it came to dwarf the stock market, the bond market eluded serious regulation. Bond salesmen could say and do anything without fear that they'd be reported to some authority. Bond traders could exploit inside information without worrying that they would be caught. Bond technicians could dream up ever more complicated securities without worrying too much about government regulation, one reason why so many derivatives had been derived, one way or another, from bonds. The bigger, more liquid end of the bond market, the market for U.S. Treasury bonds, for example, traded on screens, but in many cases the only way to determine if the price some bond trader had given you was even close to fair was to call around and hope to find some other bond trader making a market in that particular obscure security. The opacity and complexity of the bond market was, for big Wall Street firms, a huge advantage. The bond market customer lived in perpetual fear of what he didn't know. If Wall Street bond departments were increasingly the source of Wall Street profits, it was in part because of this. In the bond market, it was still possible to make huge sums of money from the fear and the ignorance of customers. And so it was no particular reflection on Greg Lipman that, upon entering Steve Eisman's office, he collided with a wall of suspicion. Moses could have walked in the door, and if he said he came from fixed income, Vinny wouldn't have trusted him, said Eisman. Still, if a team of experts had set out to create a human being to maximize the likelihood that he would terrify a Wall Street customer, they might have designed something like Lipman. He traded bonds for Deutsche Bank, but like most people who traded bonds for Deutsche Bank, or Credit Suisse, or UBS, or one of the other big foreign banks who had purchased a toehold in the U.S. financial markets, he was an American. Thin and tightly wound, he spoke too quickly for anyone to follow exactly what he was saying. He wore his hair slicked back, in the manner of Gordon Gekko, and the sideburns long, in the fashion of an 1820s romantic composer, or a 1970s porn star. He wore loud ties and said outrageous things without the slightest apparent awareness of how they might sound if repeated unsympathetically. He peppered his conversation with cryptic references to how much money he made, for instance. People on Wall Street had long ago learned that their bonuses were the last thing they should talk about with people off Wall Street. "Let's say they paid me $6 million last year," Lipman would say. "I'm not saying they did. It was less than that. I'm not saying how much less." Before you could protest, "But I never asked," he'd say, "The kind of year I had, no way they pay me less than $4 million." Now he had you thinking about it. "So the number is between $4 million and $6 million. You could have started out talking about New York City Ballet, and you wound up playing Battleship. Lipman kept giving you these coordinates until you were almost forced to identify the location of the ship, exactly what just about everyone else on Wall Street hoped you'd never do. In further violation of the code, Lipman was quick to let people know that whatever he'd been paid by his employer was not anything like what he'd been worth. "Senior management's job is to pay people," he'd say. "If they fuck 100 guys out of $100 grand each, that's $10 million more for them. They have 4 categories, happy, satisfied, dissatisfied, disgusted. If they hit happy, they've screwed up. They never want you happy. On the other hand, they don't want you so disgusted you quit. The sweet spot is somewhere between dissatisfied and disgusted." At some point in between 1986 and 2006, a memo had gone out on Wall Street saying that if you wanted to keep on getting rich, shuffling bits of paper around to no obvious social purpose, you had better camouflage your true nature. Greg Lipman was incapable of disguising himself or his motives. "I don't have any particular allegiance to Deutsche Bank," he'd say. "I just work there." This was not an unusual attitude. What was unusual was that Lipman said it. The least controversial thing to be said about Lipman was that he was controversial. He wasn't just a good bond trader. He was a great bond trader. He wasn't cruel. He wasn't even rude, at least not intentionally. He simply evoked extreme feelings in others. A trader who worked near him for years referred to him as the asshole known as Greg Lipman. When asked why, he said, he took everything too far. I love Greg, said one of his bosses at Deutsche Bank. I have nothing bad to say about him except that he's a fucking whack job. But when you cleared away the controversy around Lipman's persona, you could see it was rooted in two simple complaints. The first was that he was transparently self-interested and self-promotional. The second was that he was excessively alert to the self-interest and self-promotion of others. He had an almost freakish ability to identify shadowy motives. If you had just donated $20 million to your alma mater, say, and were feeling the glow of selfless devotion to a cause greater than yourself, Lipman would be the first to ask, "So you gave $20 million because that's the minimum to get your name on a building, right?" Now this character turns up out of nowhere to sell Steve Eisman on what he claims is his own original brilliant idea for betting against the subprime mortgage bond market. He made his case with a long and involved 42-page presentation. Over the past 3 years, housing prices had risen far more rapidly than they had over the previous 30. Housing prices had not yet fallen, but they had ceased to rise. Even so, the loans against them were now going sour in their first year at amazing rates, up from 1% to 4%. Who borrowed money to buy a house and defaulted inside of 12 months? He went on for a bit, then showed Eisman this little chart that he'd created, and which he claimed was the reason he had become interested in the trade. It illustrated an astonishing fact. Since 2000, people whose homes had risen in value between 1 and 5% were nearly four times more likely to default on their home loans than people whose homes had risen in value more than 10%. Millions of Americans had no ability to repay their mortgages unless their houses rose dramatically in value, which enabled them to borrow even more. That was the pitch in a nutshell. Home prices didn't even need to fall. They merely needed to stop rising at the unprecedented rates they had the previous few years for vast numbers of Americans to default on their home loans. Shorting home equity mezzanine tranches, Lipman called his presentation. Shorting home equity mezzanine tranches was just a fancy way to describe Mike Berry's idea of betting against U.S. home loans, buying credit default swaps on the crappiest triple B slices of subprime mortgage bonds. Lipman himself described it more bluntly to a Deutsche Bank colleague who had seen the presentation and dubbed him Chicken Little. "Fuck you," Lipman had said. "I'm short your house." The beauty of the credit default swap, or CDS, was that it solved the timing problem. Eisman no longer needed to guess exactly when the subprime mortgage market would crash. It also allowed him to make the bet without laying down cash up front, and put him in a position to win many times the sums he could possibly lose. Worst case, insolvent Americans somehow paid off their subprime mortgage loans, and you were stuck paying an insurance premium of roughly 2% a year for as long as 6 years, the longest expected lifespan of the putatively 30-year loans. The alacrity with which subprime borrowers paid off their loans was yet another strange aspect of this booming market. It had to do with the structure of the loans, which were fixed for 2 or 3 years at an artificially low teaser rate before shooting up to the go-to floating rate. They were making loans to lower-income people at a teaser rate when they knew they couldn't afford to pay the go-to rate, said Eisman. They were doing it so that when the borrowers get to the end of the teaser rate period, they'd have to refinance so the lenders can make more money off them. 30-year loans were thus designed to be repaid in a few years. At worst, if you bought credit default swaps on $100 million in subprime mortgage bonds, you might wind up shelling out premium for 6 years, call it $12 million. At best, losses on the loans rose from the current 4% to 8%, and you made $100 million. The bookies were offering you odds of somewhere between 6 to 1 and 10 to 1, when the odds of it working out felt more like 2 to 1. Anyone in the business of making smart bets couldn't not do it. The argument stopper was Lipman's one-man quantitative support team. His name was Eugene Zhu, but to those who'd heard Lipman's pitch, he was generally spoken of as Lipman's Chinese quant. Zhu was an analyst employed by Deutsche Bank, but Lipman gave everyone the idea he kept him tied up to his Bloomberg terminal like a pet. a real Chinese guy, not even Chinese American, who apparently spoke no English, just numbers. China had this national math competition, Lippmann told people, in which Eugene had finished second, in all of China. Eugene Zhu was responsible for every piece of hard data in Lippmann's presentation. Once Eugene was introduced into the equation, no one bothered Lippmann about his math or his data. As Lippmann put it, "How can a guy who can't speak English lie?" There was a lot more to it than that. Lippmann brimmed with fascinating details, the historical behavior of the American homeowner, the idiocy and corruption of the rating agencies, Moody's and S&P, who stuck a triple B rating on subprime bonds that went bad when losses in the underlying pools of home loans reached just 8%. The widespread fraud in the mortgage market, the folly of subprime mortgage investors, some large number of whom seemed to live in Dusseldorf, Germany. Whenever we'd ask him who was buying this crap, said Vinnie, he always just said, Dusseldorf. It didn't matter whether Dusseldorf was buying actual cash subprime mortgage bonds or selling credit default swaps on those same mortgage bonds, as they amounted to one and the same thing, the long side of the bet. Lippmann brimmed also with Lippmann. He hinted Eisman might get so rich from the trade he could buy the Los Angeles Dodgers. I'm not saying you're going to be able to buy the Dodgers. Eisman might become so rich that movie stars would crave his body. I'm not saying you're going to date Jessica Simpson. With one hand, Lippmann presented the facts of the trade. With the other, he tapped away like a dowser probing for a well hidden deep in Eisman's character. Keeping one eye on Greg Lippmann and the other on Steve Eisman, Vincent Daniel half expected the room to explode. Instead, Steve Eisman found nothing even faintly objectionable about Greg Lippmann. Great guy! Eisman really only had a couple of questions. The first, tell me again how the hell a credit default swap works. The second, why are you asking me to bet against bonds your own firm is creating and arranging for the ratings agencies to misrate? In my entire life, I never saw a sell-side guy come in and say, short my market, said Eisman. Lippmann wasn't even a bond salesman. He was a bond trader who might be expected to be long these very same subprime mortgage bonds. I didn't mistrust him, says Eisman. I didn't understand him. Vinnie was the one who was sure he was going to fuck us in some way. Eisman had no trouble betting against subprime mortgages. Indeed, he could imagine very little that would give him so much pleasure as the thought of going to bed each night, possibly for the next 6 years, knowing he was short a financial market he had come to know and despise and was certain would one day explode. When he walked in and said you can make money shorting subprime paper, it was like putting a naked supermodel in front of me, said Eisman. What I couldn't understand was why he wanted me to do it. That question, as it turned out, was more interesting than even Eisman suspected. The subprime mortgage market was generating $500 billion worth of new loans a year. But the circle of people redistributing the risk that the entire market would collapse was tiny. When the Goldman Sachs saleswoman called Mike Berry and told him that her firm would be happy to sell him credit default swaps in $100 million chunks, Berry guessed, rightly, that Goldman wasn't ultimately on the other side of his bets. Goldman would never be so stupid as to make huge naked bets that millions of insolvent Americans would repay their home loans. He didn't know who or why or how much, but he knew that some giant corporate entity with a triple-A rating was out there selling credit default swaps on subprime mortgage bonds. Only a triple-A-rated corporation could assume such risk, no money down and no questions asked. Berry was right about this, too, but it would be 3 years before he knew it. The party on the other side of his bet against subprime mortgage bonds was the AAA-rated insurance company AIG, American International Group, Incorporated, or rather, a unit of AIG called AIGFP. AIG Financial Products was created in 1987 by refugees from Michael Milken's bond department at Drexel Burnham, led by a trader named Howard Sossen, who claimed to have a better model to trade and value interest rate swaps. 1980s financial innovation had all sorts of consequences, but one of them was a boom in the number of deals between big financial firms that required them to take each other's credit risks. Interest rate swaps, in which one party swaps a floating rate of interest for another party's fixed rate of interest, was one such innovation. Once upon a time, Chrysler issued a bond through Morgan Stanley, and the only people who wound up with credit risk were the investors who bought the Chrysler bond. Chrysler might sell its bonds and simultaneously enter into a 10-year interest rate swap transaction with Morgan Stanley. And just like that, Chrysler and Morgan Stanley were exposed to each other. If Chrysler went bankrupt, its bondholders obviously lost. Depending on the nature of the swap and the movement of interest rates, Morgan Stanley might lose too. If Morgan Stanley went bust, Chrysler, along with anyone else who had done interest rate swaps with Morgan Stanley, stood to suffer. Financial risk had been created out of thin air, and it begged to be either honestly accounted for or disguised. Enter Sossen with his supposedly new and improved interest rate swap model, even though Drexel Burnham was not at the time a market leader in interest rate swaps. There was a natural role for a blue-chip corporation with the highest credit rating to stand in the middle of swaps and long-term options and the other risk-spawning innovations. The traits required of this corporation were that it not be a bank, and thus subject to bank regulation and the need to reserve capital against risky assets, and that it be willing and able to bury exotic risks on its balance sheet. It needed to be able to insure $100 billion in subprime mortgage loans, for instance, without having to disclose to anyone what it had done. There was no real reason that company had to be AIG. It could have been any AAA-rated entity with a huge balance sheet. Berkshire Hathaway, for instance, or General Electric. AIG just got there first. In a financial system that was rapidly generating complicated risks, AIGFP became a huge swallower of those risks. In the early days, it must have seemed as if it was being paid to ensure events extremely unlikely to occur, as it was. Its success bred imitators. Zurich Re FP, Swiss Re FP, Credit Suisse FP, Gen Re FP. RE stands for reinsurance. All of these places were central to what happened in the last two decades. Without them, the new risks being created would have had no place to hide and would have remained in full view of bank regulators. All of these places, when the crisis came, would be washed away by the general nausea felt in the presence of complicated financial risks, but there was a moment when their existence seemed cartographically necessary to the financial world. AIGFP was the model for them all. The division's first 15 years were consistently amazingly profitable. There wasn't the first hint that it might be running risks that would cause it to lose money, much less cripple its giant parent. In 1993, when Howard Sossen left, he took with him nearly $200 million, his share of what appeared to be a fantastic money machine. In 1998, AIGFP entered the new market for corporate credit default swaps. It sold insurance to banks against the risk of defaults by huge numbers of investment-grade public corporations. The credit default swap had just been invented by bankers at J.P. Morgan, who then went looking for a AAA-rated company willing to sell them, and found AIGFP. The market began innocently enough, by Wall Street standards. Large numbers of investment-grade companies in different countries and different industries were indeed unlikely to default on their debt at the same time. The credit default swaps sold by AIGFP that insured pools of such loans proved to be a good business. By 2001, AIGFP, now being run by a fellow named Joe Cassano, could be counted on to generate $300 million a year, or 15% of AIG's profits. But then, in the early 2000s, the financial markets performed this fantastic bait-and-switch in two stages. Stage one was to apply a formula that had been dreamed up to cope with corporate credit risk to consumer credit risk. The banks that used AIGFP to insure piles of loans to IBM and GE now came to it to insure much messier piles, which included credit card debt, student loans, auto loans, prime mortgages, aircraft leases, and just about anything else that generated a cash flow. As there were many different sorts of loans to different sorts of people, the logic that had applied to corporate loans seemed to apply to them too. They were sufficiently diverse that they were unlikely all to go bad at once. Stage 2, beginning at the end of 2004, was to replace the student loans and the auto loans and the rest with bigger piles consisting of nothing but U.S. subprime mortgage loans. The problem, as one AIGFP trader put it, is that something else came along that we thought was the same thing as what we'd been doing. The consumer loan piles that Wall Street firms, led by Goldman Sachs, asked AIGFP to insure went from being 2% subprime mortgages to being 95% subprime mortgages. In a matter of months, AIGFP, in effect, bought $50 billion in BBB-rated subprime mortgage bonds by insuring them against default. And yet no one said anything about it. Not AIG CEO Martin Sullivan, not the head of AIGFP, Joe Cassano, not the guy in AIGFP's Connecticut office in charge of selling his firm's credit default swap services to the big Wall Street firms, Al Frost. The deals, by all accounts, were simply rubber-stamped inside AIGFP, and then again by AIG Brass. Everyone concerned apparently assumed they were being paid insurance premiums to take basically the same sort of risk they had been taking for nearly a decade. They weren't. They were now, in effect, the world's biggest owners of subprime mortgage bonds. Greg Lipman watched his counterparts at Goldman Sachs find and exploit someone else's willingness to sell huge amounts of cheap insurance on subprime mortgage bonds and pretty much instantly guessed the seller's identity. Word spread quickly in the small world of subprime mortgage bond creators and traders. AIGFP was now selling credit default swaps on AAA-rated subprime bonds for a mere 0.12% a year, 12 basis points. Lipman didn't know exactly how Goldman Sachs had persuaded AIGFP to provide the same service to the booming market in subprime mortgage loans that it provided to the market for corporate loans. All he knew was that, in rapid succession, Goldman created a bunch of multi-billion dollar deals that transferred to AIG the responsibility for all future losses from $20 billion in BBB-rated subprime mortgage bonds. It was incredible. In exchange for a few million bucks a year, this insurance company was taking the very real risk that $20 billion would simply go poof. The deals with Goldman had gone down in a matter of months and required the efforts of just a few geeks on a Goldman bond trading desk and a Goldman salesman named Andrew Davelman, who for his services soon would be promoted to managing director. The Goldman traders had booked profits of somewhere between $1.5 billion and $3 billion, even by bond market standards, a breathtaking sum. In the process, Goldman Sachs created a security so opaque and complex that it would remain forever misunderstood by investors and rating agencies, the Synthetic Subprime Mortgage Bond-Backed CDO, or Collateralized Debt Obligation. Like the credit default swap, the CDO had been invented to redistribute the risk of corporate and government bond defaults and was now being rejiggered to disguise the risk of subprime mortgage loans. Its logic was exactly that of the original mortgage bonds. In a mortgage bond, you gathered thousands of loans and, assuming that it was extremely unlikely that they would all go bad together, created a tower of bonds in which both risk and return diminished as you rose. In a CDO, you gathered 100 different mortgage bonds, usually the riskiest lower floors of the original tower, and used them to erect an entirely new tower of bonds. The innocent observer might reasonably ask, what's the point of using floors from one tower of debt simply to create another tower of debt? The short answer is, they are too near the ground. More prone to flooding, the first to take losses, they bear a lower credit rating, BBB. BBB-rated bonds were harder to sell than the AAA-rated ones on the safe upper floors of the building. The long answer was that there were huge sums of money to be made if you could somehow get them re-rated as AAA, thereby lowering their perceived risk, however dishonestly and artificially. This is what Goldman Sachs had cleverly done. There, soon to be everyone's nifty solution to the problem of selling the lower floors appears, in retrospect, almost magical. Having gathered 100 ground floors from 100 different subprime mortgage buildings, 100 different BBB-rated bonds, they persuaded the rating agencies that these weren't, as they might appear, all exactly the same things. They were another diversified portfolio of assets. This was absurd. The 100 buildings occupied the same floodplain. In the event of flood, the ground floors of all of them were equally exposed. But never mind. The rating agencies, who were paid fat fees by Goldman Sachs and other Wall Street firms for each deal they rated, pronounced 80% of the new tower of debt AAA. The CDO was, in effect, a credit laundering service for the residents of lower middle-class America. For Wall Street, it was a machine that turned lead into gold. Back in the 1980s, the original stated purpose of the mortgage-backed bond had been to redistribute the risk associated with home mortgage lending. Home mortgage loans could find their way to the bond market investors willing to pay the most for them. The interest rate paid by the homeowner would thus fall. The goal of the innovation, in short, was to make the financial markets more efficient. Now, somehow, the same innovative spirit was being put to the opposite purpose, to hide the risk by complicating it. The market was paying Goldman Sachs bond traders to make the market less efficient. With stagnant wages and booming consumption, the cash-strapped American masses had a virtually unlimited demand for loans, but an uncertain ability to repay them. All they had going for them, from the point of view of Wall Street financial engineers, was that their financial fates could be misconstrued as uncorrelated. By assuming that one pile of subprime mortgage loans wasn't exposed to the same forces as another, that a subprime mortgage bond with loans heavily concentrated in Florida wasn't very much like a subprime mortgage bond more concentrated in California, the engineers created the illusion of security. AIGFP accepted the illusion as reality. The people who worked on the relevant Goldman Sachs mortgage bond trading desk were all extremely intelligent. They'd all done amazingly well in school and had gone to Ivy League universities. But it didn't require any sort of genius to see the fortune to be had from the laundering of BBB-rated bonds into AAA-rated bonds. What demanded genius was finding $20 billion in BBB-rated bonds to launder. In the original Tower of Loans, the original mortgage bond, only a single thin floor got rated BBB. $1 billion of crappy home loans might yield just $20 million of the crappiest BBB tranches. Put another way, to create a $1 billion CDO composed solely of BBB-rated subprime mortgage bonds, you needed to lend $50 billion in cash to actual human beings. That took time and effort. A credit default swap took neither. There was more than one way to think about Mike Berry's purchase of $1 billion in credit default swaps. The first was a simple, even innocent, insurance contract. Berry made his semi-annual premium payments and, in return, received protection against the default of $1 billion worth of bonds. He'd either be paid zero, if the BBB-rated bonds he'd insured proved good, or $1 billion, if those BBB-rated bonds went bad. But, of course, Mike Berry didn't own any BBB-rated subprime mortgage bonds or anything like them. He had no property to insure. It was as if he had bought fire insurance on some slum with a history of burning down. To him, as to Steve Eisman, a credit default swap wasn't insurance at all, but an outright speculative bet against the market. And this was the second way to think about it. There was also a third, even more mind-bending way to think of this new instrument, as a near-perfect replica of a subprime mortgage bond. The cash flows of Mike Berry's credit default swaps replicated the cash flows of the BBB-rated subprime mortgage bond that he wagered against. The 2.5% a year in premium Mike Berry was paying mimicked the spread over LIBOR, the London Interbank Offered Rate, that BBB subprime mortgage bonds paid to an actual investor. The $1 billion whoever had sold Mike Berry his credit default swaps stood to lose, if the bonds went bad, replicated the potential losses of an actual bond owner. On its surface, the booming market and side bets on subprime mortgage bonds seemed to be the financial equivalent of fantasy football, a benign, if silly, facsimile of investing. Alas, there was a difference between fantasy football and fantasy finance. When a fantasy football player drafts Peyton Manning to be on his team, he doesn't create a second Peyton Manning. When Mike Berry bought a credit default swap based on a Long Beach Savings subprime-backed bond, he enabled Goldman Sachs to create another bond identical to the original in every respect but one. There were no actual home loans or home buyers. Only the gains and losses from the side bet on the bonds were real. And so, to generate $1 billion in BBB-rated subprime mortgage bonds, Goldman Sachs did not need to originate $50 billion in home loans. They simply needed to entice Mike Berry or some other market pessimist to pick 100 different BBB bonds and buy $10 million in credit default swaps on each of them. Once they had this package, a synthetic CDO, it was called, which was the term of art for a CDO composed of nothing but credit default swaps, they'd take it over to Moody's and Standard & Poor's. The ratings agencies didn't really have their own CDO model, says one former Goldman CDO trader. The banks would send over their own model to Moody's and say, "How does this look?" Somehow, roughly 80% of what had been risky BBB-rated bonds now looked like AAA-rated bonds. The other 20%, bearing lower credit ratings, generally were more difficult to sell, but they could, incredibly, simply be piled up in yet another heap and reprocessed yet again into more AAA bonds. The machine that turned 100% lead into an ore that was now 80% gold and 20% lead would accept the residual lead and turn 80% of that into gold, too. The details were complicated, but the gist of this new money machine was not. It turned a lot of dicey loans into a pile of bonds, most of which were AAA-rated. Then it took the lowest-rated of the remaining bonds and turned most of those into AAA CDOs. And then, because it could not extend home loans fast enough to create a sufficient number of lower-rated bonds, it used credit default swaps to replicate the very worst of the existing bonds many times over. Goldman Sachs stood between Michael Berry and AIG. Michael Berry forked out 250 basis points, 2.5%, to own credit default swaps on the very crappiest BBB bonds, and AIG paid a mere 12 basis points, 0.12%, to sell credit default swaps on those very same bonds, filtered through a synthetic CDO and pronounced AAA rated. There were a few other messy details. Some of the lead was sold off directly to German investors in Düsseldorf, but when the dust settled, Goldman Sachs had taken roughly 2% off the top, risk-free, and booked all the profit up front. There was no need on either side, long or short, for cash to change hands. Both sides could do a deal with Goldman Sachs by signing a piece of paper. The original home mortgage loans on whose fate both sides were betting played no other role. In a funny way, they existed only so that their fate might be gambled upon. The market for synthetics removed any constraint on the size of risk associated with subprime mortgage lending. To make a billion-dollar bet, you no longer needed to accumulate $1 billion worth of actual mortgage loans. All you had to do was find someone else in the market willing to take the other side of the bet. No wonder Goldman Sachs was suddenly so eager to sell Mike Berry credit default swaps in giant $100 million chunks, or that the Goldman Sachs bond trader had been surprisingly indifferent to which subprime bonds Mike Berry bet against. The insurance Mike Berry bought was inserted into a synthetic CDO and passed along to AIG. The roughly $20 billion in credit default swaps sold by AIG to Goldman Sachs meant roughly $400 million in riskless profits for Goldman Sachs each year. The deals lasted as long as the underlying bonds, which had an expected life of about 6 years, which, when you did the math, implied a profit for the Goldman trader of $2.4 billion. Wall Street's newest technique for squeezing profits out of the bond markets should have raised a few questions. Why were supposedly sophisticated traders at AIGFP doing this stuff? If credit default swaps were insurance, why weren't they regulated as insurance? Why, for example, wasn't AIG required to reserve capital against them? Why, for that matter, were Moody's and Standard & Poor's willing to bless 80% of a pool of dicey mortgage loans with the same AAA rating they bestowed on the debts of the U.S. Treasury? Why didn't someone, anyone, inside Goldman Sachs stand up and say, "This is obscene. The rating agencies, the ultimate pricers of all these subprime mortgage loans, clearly do not understand the risk, and their idiocy is creating a recipe for catastrophe." Apparently, none of those questions popped into the minds of market insiders as quickly as another. How do I do what Goldman Sachs just did? Deutsche Bank especially felt something like shame that Goldman Sachs had been the first to find this particular pay dirt. Along with Goldman, Deutsche Bank was the leading market maker in abstruse mortgage derivatives. Dusseldorf was playing some kind of role in the new market. If there were stupid Germans standing ready to buy U.S. subprime mortgage derivatives, Deutsche Bank should have been the first to find them. None of this was of any obvious concern to Greg Lippmann. Lippmann did not run Deutsche Bank's CDO business. A fellow named Michael Lamont did. Lippmann was merely the trader responsible for buying and selling subprime mortgage bonds, and by extension, credit default swaps on subprime mortgage bonds. But with so few investors willing to make an outright bet against the subprime bond market, Lippmann's bosses asked Lippmann to take one for the team, in effect, to serve as a stand-in for Mike Berry and to make an explicit bet against the market. If Lippmann would buy credit default swaps from Deutsche Bank's CDO department, they, too, might do these trades with AIG before AIG woke up and stopped doing them. Greg was forced to get short into the CDOs, says a former senior member of Deutsche Bank's CDO team. I say forced, but you can't really force Greg to do anything. There was some pushing and pulling with the people who ran his firm's CDO operations, but Lippmann found himself uncomfortably short subprime mortgage bonds. Lippmann had at least one good reason for not putting up a huge fight. There was a fantastically profitable market waiting to be created. Financial markets are a collection of arguments. The less transparent the market and the more complicated the securities, the more money the trading desks at big Wall Street firms can make from the argument. The constant argument over the value of the shares of some major publicly traded company has very little value, as both buyer and seller can see the fair price of the stock on the ticker, and the broker's commission has been driven down by competition. The argument over the value of credit default swaps on subprime mortgage bonds, a complex security whose value was derived from that of another complex security, could be a gold mine. The only other dealer making serious markets in credit default swaps was Goldman Sachs, so there was, in the beginning, little price competition. Supply, thanks to AIG, was virtually unlimited. The problem was demand, investors who wanted to do Mike Berry's trade. Incredibly, at this critical juncture in financial history, after which so much changed so quickly, the only constraint in the subprime mortgage market was a shortage of people willing to bet against it. To sell investors on the idea of betting against subprime mortgage bonds on buying his pile of credit default swaps, Greg Lippmann needed a new and improved argument. Enter the great Chinese quant. Lippmann asked Eugene Zhu to study the effect of home price appreciation on subprime mortgage loans. Eugene Zhu went off and did whatever the second smartest man in China does, and at length returned with a chart illustrating default rates in various home price scenarios. Home price is up, home price is flat, home price is down. Lippmann looked at it, and looked again. The numbers shocked even him. They didn't need to collapse. They merely needed to stop rising so fast. House prices were still rising, and yet default rates were approaching 4%. If they rose to just 7%, the lowest investment-grade bonds rated BBB- went to zero. If they rose to 8%, the next lowest rated bonds, rated triple B, went to zero. At that moment, in November 2005, Greg Lippman realized that he didn't mind owning a pile of credit default swaps on subprime mortgage bonds. They weren't insurance. They were a gamble, and he liked the odds. He wanted to be short. This was new. Greg Lippman had traded bonds backed by various